At the beginning of June 2015, ILSR released its Public Rooftop Revolution Report, which described how cities across the nation could put the shine on municipal rooftops with more than 5,000 megawatts of solar. That 5,000 megawatts is as much as one quarter of all solar installed on the U.S. to date, and many cities could install solar for little or no upfront cash. The energy savings would allow cities to redirect millions to other public goods. ILSR's Director of Democratic Energy, John Farrell, presented the report's findings in a webinar hosted by Applied Solutions on June 9, 2015. But time constraints meant many unanswered questions. In the first guest-hosted episode, John answers questions from Carolyn Glanton of Applied Solutions on everything from the expiration of federal tax credits to the payback period for municipal solar arrays. This is Local Energy Rules, a podcast sharing powerful stories about local renewable energy.
So, what opportunities are available with the expiration of the federal tax credit for wind and solar?
That's a great question. You know, the way I look at this is that all of the financial and financing structures for renewable energy have been revolve around that federal tax credit, the 30% federal tax credit. And that means that any entity, whether it's a nonprofit or a for-profit, is trying to find some sort of partner that can take advantage of it and lower the cost of the installation. But these middlemen always take a cut of that. So for example, and it creates problems. So for example, during the financial crisis in 2008, when a lot of the Wall Street firms that had traditionally been taking these incentives did not have any tax liability because they were losing money hand over fist, there all of a sudden it was difficult for wind and solar developers whose businesses were continuing to grow to find partners that they could work with for financing because nobody needed these tax credits. The federal government had to step in and transition it to a cash grant for a two-year period between 2009 and 2011. What I see there then with that background is that the expiration of the tax credits is going to give us a chance to look at financing tools that don't involve those middlemen, that there might be institutional investors that, for example, that have expect lower returns than Wall Street firms that will be willing to lend money at lower interest rates and lower project costs. And I think there's already some evidence from numbers that I've crunched, for example, that suggest that we could cover the loss of at least one of those tax incentives, the tax credit or the depreciation, simply with lower financing costs in the near term. So there might be some really good opportunities, I think, to expand lower cost financing and make it much more accessible to a whole bunch of different entities.
Well, that's great to know that just because the federal tax credit is expiring, that there still are other opportunities out there. So the next question, we had lots of people around the world even interested in this report that you provided on the rooftop solar. So one question was, do you have any advice on financing for countries other than the U.S.? An example is local councils in Africa. Or also in general, what kind of legal issues does one have to put into consideration when you are dealing with something such as rooftop solar?
I'm going to have to be very general in my response because I don't have any kind of expertise with kind of the finance and policy structures in other countries, or very limited experience. What I would say, though, in terms of that policy framework is that policies like what Germany and Denmark and other countries have used called a feed-in tariff, it's much more common in Europe, are much better in terms of setting up the financing structure for renewable energy projects. They basically say that anybody who wants to connect to the grid with a solar or wind project can get a guaranteed 20-year contract at an attractive price, enough to both make back their costs and make a small return on investment. And these have been very, very successful at allowing a wide range of kinds of ownership structures for projects, much more so than in the United States, where we've relied on tax incentives. So I think that's one piece to look at. And then the other one, of course, is this issue of finding the right ownership structure. Something I've written about before is that it's very difficult to have, for example, community-based renewable energy projects in the United States because it's difficult to align the kind of legal entity that you have, like a nonprofit organization, with the tax incentives. And so a lot of the entities we would use for community-based projects aren't eligible to get those incentives and therefore have to pay a higher price.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And following up, can a municipality install solar for benefits of its residents yet? In other words, can a municipality install a large array to feed back into the grid and benefit its residents?
This is a great question because we're sort of testing that theory a little bit in Minneapolis right now. So there are two answers to this question. The first one is if the municipality owns its own utility, therefore has a city-owned utility like some 2,000 cities in the United States, yes, you can do that already because you can just decide that you're going to purchase solar energy systems for local consumption for the electric grid for all the customers. And you see that, for example, San Antonio or Austin Energy in Texas, the Sacramento Municipal District in California are already able to go out and purchase solar on behalf of everyone. That opportunity is already there. What we haven't seen as much of is cities without utilities purchasing solar on behalf of their residents. And it's a little bit tricky. There's a couple ways that this could happen. One is, and we're looking at this in Minneapolis right now as part of this city utility partnership program, is could the city get some sort of tariff, which means a price that it would pay to buy energy, say, from a wind developer outside of the city, that the utility would basically have an access fee to use the grid that would allow the city to go out and purchase clean energy. As far as I understand it, that would probably only apply to the city's own internal electric use and not the use for residents and businesses. But it would, by potentially lowering the cost of energy, be a benefit in terms of freeing up more of the city's budget for public priorities. There are also other ways in which the city could own wind and solar arrays and finance them themselves and simply sell the energy to the grid in that same fashion, reduce the energy cost to the city. As far as installing solar for the benefits of its residents, sort of like community solar, I think one other possibility is with community solar arrays, where you could have the city as sort of an anchor tenant on a community solar project, either built within the city or outside the city, presuming you are in a community in which community solar is allowed. The city could subscribe to purchase, say, half the energy from that solar array, and then other residents and businesses could subscribe to the other portion. It would be the city helping make that project happen, and by being the anchor tenant, making sure that it is financeable, but it might be residents and businesses that are able to subscribe and lower their energy bills. There haven't been, in the structure of that question, I sort of catch this notion of the city doing it in a way that is of direct economic benefit to the residents. And there haven't been very many examples of that because you get into some interesting issues about spending public dollars for private benefit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that answer, John. The next question, how about gross metering for solar rooftop projects?
I have to confess, I'm not sure that I understand this question. I don't know, Carolyn, if you have any more insight as to what the questioner might have been getting at.
I'm not familiar with the gross metering term. Net metering, possibly?
The only thing I can think of is this is sort of that contrast between net metering and a feed-in tariff, whereas net metering, the solar array is attached to the same meter and it simply spins it backwards, offsetting your energy consumption. The mechanics of a feed-in tariff require 2 meters because you are selling all the energy you produce to the utility and continuing to buy all the energy you consume from the utility. And so when you talk about gross metering, I think of that process of selling all the energy to the utility for solar rooftop projects. And the problem with that is simply that most utilities, when you ask them what they're willing to pay for power that you simply are putting into the grid, it's a very, very low price that reflects what they can buy on the wholesale market. And so I don't think that's a very good concept. I think that you have to have, usually with a feed-in tariff, some sort of agreed upon way of coming at a value that is attractive to the customer as well as to the utility.
Thank you for that answer, John. And how should those who are interested in finding PPA providers begin their search? We specifically had a webinar attendee ask about PPA providers who work in Ohio. I'm not sure if you're can suggest anyone in specifically, but what would you suggest for how they should begin their search?
That's a tough question. I mean, quite frankly, I can only think of this in the context of what I would do, which is I would get on Google and start looking for somebody who could sell me solar in Ohio or wherever it is that I live. And then I would probably also look to some sort of third-party rating service like Angie's List to find out whether or not they have a good record in terms of the stuff that they've delivered, or ask them for some references of customers for whom they've done a power purchase agreement so that I could call them up myself and ask how that went and whether or not they're saving money. That's actually a fairly important issue. I just finished a conversation with someone from the Sacramento Municipal Utility this morning, and they have done some surveys of their electric customers about the power purchase and leasing contracts that they've signed, and said that only about 20% of them, in the admittedly small sample size that they had, were actually saving money with these lease and power purchase agreements. And so it is a rather important issue to make sure that you've done your homework and found the right person that that will actually result in you saving money on your energy bill, if in fact that's your primary motivation.
Okay, good to know. And can you quickly explain again why a third-party ownership is needed?
The simple answer to that question is it's not needed. You certainly can do solar without having a third party. A city can do solar without having a third party. It's just that it, especially given the structure of our financial incentives for solar and, no, it's just given that the structure of the financial incentives for solar make it a lot easier if you have a third party. You know, like I've mentioned many times, the federal tax incentives aren't available to cities that are tax exempt. And so it's only through a third party that they can access those incentives. And just second of all, that cities in particular are always having lots of different priorities competing for their budget dollars. And so a third party that can offer a zero money down opportunity for a city that is not on the capital budget or the operating budget is a very attractive thing for a city council that sees itself as cash strapped.
Agreed. And a follow-up question to that, does Michigan have a third-party ownership agreement?
I don't have the map in front of me, but I have published it on ILSR's website along with the Public Rooftop Revolution report, so I would just refer folks there. I believe Michigan does not allow the power purchase agreements.
Okay. And how would the cash flows work under a PPA? Would the municipality have to pay anything up front?
That's a great question. As I understand it, most power purchase agreements don't have an upfront charge. That's not to say that that's what somebody would offer you if you went out for a bid today. And then as far as the cash flows, it varies. The basic principle behind a power purchase agreement is that you will sign up a contract for a predictable energy cost over the next 15 to 20 year term. But it may mean that you pay a little bit more right now than you have been paying, but that you have a fixed price for 20 years. It might mean that you pay a little less than you're paying right now, but that there is an inflation adjustment in the amount that you pay on that agreement. And the savings, the presumed savings, come from the difference between that interest, that inflation rate and the actual inflation rate in electricity prices. So say, for example, your power purchase contract will go up by 1% per year, and you anticipate electricity prices to rise 3% per year. So that difference between 1% and 3% is additional savings. But nobody really knows what's going to happen to electricity prices over the next 15 to 20 years. They have been trending up very sharply over the past decade, 4% to 5% per year. But that's not a guarantee that it will continue that way.
Okay, thank you, John. The next question comes from Bosnia. Can you please explain in short steps how you investigate buildings' potential for solar?
I can say nothing at all about the particular situation in Bosnia, but obviously I think one of the first things that you need to do is, with any kind of project for a building, is go out and get a bid from somebody who knows what they're talking about. So find solar installers, find contractors who have done this work before, who you feel like are credible, and have them give you a quote. Have them come and talk to you about the opportunity. That's what I did for my own home. Somebody came out, they looked at my house. They said, there's basically nowhere we can put solar on here. Your garage looks good. We're going to get up on your garage and test to see how much it's in the sun over the course of a given year with a little measuring tool that they have. We're going to measure it. We're going to look at the structural beams underneath it and make sure that it's able to bear the weight of a solar installation. We're going to look at where your meter is and where we would do that. So all of those things obviously are going to be involved with any building. And I'd say find an expert as your first step.
Okay, good to know. Thanks, John. And next question, can you discuss transaction cost basis by type of method and if or how it has changed over time?
So I think this question was specific to this issue of third-party arrangements for cities and the transaction costs in dealing with third parties in order to access the federal tax incentives. I don't have a very deep level of detail about how those calculations were made. I've relied on reporting from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and others who have studied in aggregate those transaction costs and have found that, generally speaking, about 50 cents on the dollar of those tax incentives is lost to cities in working with a third party as the result of the returns required by that partner, the financial returns that they require. So I don't know that I can say anything in more detail. I would add one other thing, however, which is that during the time in which the federal government allowed the cash grant option, there were many more community-based renewable energy projects that were successfully financed, and a higher portion of the money from the federal government actually went to those projects. There is a distinction in terms of the way that we provide that incentive. And if we give it as cash instead of as a tax benefit, we can get more of that money to the ultimate customer because it doesn't require partnerships with these tax entities. I can't get into more detail than that.
Okay. And maybe a follow-up question to that. Why is there no transaction cost for the private sector? Don't they also have to pay legal fees and other costs?
That's a good question. The transaction costs that I was specifically talking about were for the city to have to partner with a private entity in order to access tax incentives. And a private entity like a small business or an IKEA or whoever else wants to go out and do solar may have a tax appetite that they can offset with the tax incentives themselves that don't require a third party. And so I wasn't speaking specifically to the transaction costs writ large for installing solar, of which, you know, legal fees and permitting and whatever would all be a part, but simply the transaction cost to access the tax incentives, which really only applies to non-taxable entities like cities.
Okay. Thanks, John. And a specific question, have you worked with the Tennessee Valley Authority with installing a solar array?
This is an easy one. No.
And why don't municipalities set incentives for private citizens to use their roofs to generate solar power? The potential could be far larger. Is that correct?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question. There are a lot of different ways that municipalities could encourage people to do solar. You certainly could throw money at it by giving people incentives to install solar, but then you're essentially competing with other public priorities. So who's to say that a dollar spent getting a private individual to put solar on their roof for their private benefit is better than spending a dollar on road maintenance or libraries? So that kind of question is always going to be a big debate at cities, and one reason why cities haven't often put their own money up to incentivize the installation of solar. I think the sort of bigger question might be, what is it that cities can do, and why haven't they done everything they can to encourage private sector development? And that gets into that issue that we talked about a little bit in the presentation previously about permitting and licensing rules and other ways that the city's own rules and regulations impact the private market for solar development. And there's certainly plenty of evidence. Vote Solar has done some remarkable work and others in cataloging and mapping out where there are leading cities in terms of reducing those costs and what are the best practices. In the interview I had with Brent Sloan from Sacramento Municipal Utility this morning, he talked about how they went out. This is a municipal utility, mind you. They serve seven different jurisdictions in their service territory. And when they were interested in doing solar, they went out and talked to all seven of those jurisdictions and said, here's our standard package for solar that we're going to install. Can you work with us on minimizing the costs to our customers from permitting and from those other things? So there certainly are opportunities for cities to make solar more economical and realize that greater potential that exists on their rooftops of the, you know, residents and businesses in their city. But using their general fund dollars to subsidize those installations is generally not seen as an appropriate use of city funds relative to many other city priorities.
Okay. And what would you say is the typical payback period for a municipality on a project that they might install?
If there was a typical city, I could give you a typical answer, but I think it really, as we highlighted in the Public Rooftop Revolution report, the five featured cities we have, you have such variation in two really key factors. One is, how good is your solar resource? So Lancaster, California gets something like 30% more kilowatt hours out of a similarly sized solar array than, for example, Kansas City, Missouri in a given year. And so your solar resource matters a huge amount in terms of, because the more solar you produce, obviously, the more cost you're going to offset. from the same size solar array. And then the second factor is, what's the cost to buy electricity? What's the cost that you're offsetting with that solar installation? And so, you know, you have in New Bedford, Massachusetts, for example, utility rates between 15 and 20 cents a kilowatt hour. On the other hand, in Kansas City, you're offsetting utility costs or utility electricity prices more like 8 to 9 cents a kilowatt hour. There's just an awful lot of variation. In some of those very sunny places with high electricity prices, the payback period could be as low as 5 years. And in some of those other places, it might be more like 20 to 25.
Great, thanks. So next question. In California, you mentioned the ability to aggregate net energy metering accounts. Do you happen to know the size limitation of the aggregated virtual net energy metering for California and specifically PG&E?
No, I don't know much about those aggregation limits. You know, it's an interesting point because somebody followed up with me about Virginia specifically after we published the report. Because we had talked about the power purchase agreement model being legal in Virginia. And they said, actually, at the state level, there's a 50 megawatt cap total on all for the amount of capacity allowed to be installed that is contracted under a power purchase agreement. So those kinds of state level details are simply more than we had the time to be able to investigate all of. And so in other words, no, I don't know the answer to the question about California, nor specifically for PG&E.
All right. Thanks, John. And so final question. During the webinar, you mentioned that bureaucracy can be a barrier to rooftop solar. A listener who comes from such a bureaucracy wonders if you're suggesting an alternative structure to bypass this problem and implement the programs, or do you have any suggestions on working through the bureaucracy?
No, I can't say that you're really going to be able to go around the bureaucracy. I mean, that's a core piece of the functioning of a city, which has so many different responsibilities that have to be dealt with at the same time. You simply have to have different departments and specializations, and sometimes there's not a lot of overlap between those different silos, and yet solar cuts across them, and that can make it challenging. Frankly, I think that the examples that I've seen in terms of cities overcoming them really involved one of two things, or probably both. One is some political will and some desire from elected leadership saying this has to happen, and that gives cover for the folks who are within their different silos to go a little bit outside of what they've done before. And rather than talk about things in the context of, well, this is what it will cost to do that, we'll be able to say things like, well, here's how I think we could do this at a lower price, and start thinking a little bit more outside the box. And the second thing, of course, is simply having conversations among all the different people who are involved. So, you know, between the folks who license installers of solar and the folks who do permitting for solar and the building permit folks and the inspectors and all those different folks, and getting them to sit down and say, okay, well, when we have a solar installation, what is it that we're doing right now? How many times are we going to visit the property? How many times are we going to look at that solar array? And is there something that we could do different that would be more efficient from the city's perspective, but also for the customer's perspective? And would that allow us to lower the price? And I think that's one of the things that we found with the sort of best practices for solar rules in cities, is that when we use those best practices, it's not a matter of cutting around bureaucracy and setting up a new system. It's a matter of a city doing some honest accounting for how much does it actually cost us, and how can we be as efficient as possible with our resources and still have safely installed solar arrays? And the answer is usually there's quite a bit that we can do differently, and it will make everybody in the end happier.
That was John Farrell, ILSR's Director of Democratic Energy, answering questions about the Public Rooftop Revolution Report with Carolyn Glanton of Applied Solutions. His responses to these questions can be found at ilsr.org, where you can also find our Public Rooftop Revolution Report and the Local Energy Rules podcast. Until next time, keep your energy local, and thanks for listening.